Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
It's great to have you along on Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem. Ben Ross at the controls, Carissa's at the phones, and it's a new week before us here.
Yeah, and off and running. Here we go. Already, man, only a month till Thanksgiving. Can you believe that?
Yeah, that does seem, I was getting it. We had the grandkids close by, and the granddaughter's saying, oh, it's so dark this morning. I said, yeah, that's kind of what happens this time of year. And so,
that's right. We'll get some of it back in a week or so, like a couple weeks, I guess, to daylight savings time.
So. That's right. So, which is not really saving any time.
It's not really.
Yeah, speaking of, about things that grow and change, our ministry spotlight this month is the shoe that grows. There are over 300 million children who don't have shoes and countless more with shoes that don't fit. And our ministry spotlight partner is the shoe that grows. The kids receive a pair of shoes that actually grows five sizes and fits for years. Pretty amazing.
It's a big deal for kids because a lot of times they get hand-me-down shoes. Yeah. These are brand new and it stays with them for that time.
It's great. So it's our spotlight. We do a ministry spotlight once a month here on Faith Radio, and this is our October spotlight. So check it out online, myfaithradio.com, myfaithradio.com, and just love to have you become more aware of the great organizations and ministries that are making a difference. We're going to talk today with someone who has a passion for those, particularly in Guatemala, where he spent part of his years growing up. Daniel Carroll is a professor. He's the Blanchard Chair of Old Testament at the Graduate School at Wheaton College, and is also part of a Spanish language training program, and he also is an adjunct professor in Guatemala City. He's authored several books. The one that we're going to reference, which is updated here, I think, a year or so ago, called Christians at the Border, Immigration, the Church, and the Bible. And I appreciate Daniel Carroll's good perspective on this very important issue, because it is one of the most pressing issues in facing our nation today, and a lot of political rhetoric going on about this. So we're looking forward to getting Professor Carroll back on with us. Daniel, good to have you back with us. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
I was looking at some headlines, several stories, Dateline today. The DACA program, we'll have you maybe talk a little bit about that, but the protection from deportation and work permission expired on October 5th for about 21,000 of the 154,000 young immigrants who are eligible to renew the Obama-era immigration program known as DACA. The Department of Homeland Security said about 133,000 young immigrants signed up again for the Deferred Action for Children Arrivals protection, but several missed that deadline. Then also starting today, a trial set to begin this week for a Mexican man who set off a national immigration debate after he shot and killed a woman in San Francisco. And, of course, that got into safe cities, refuge cities, those things. And then one other story, the last two of eight prototypes for President Trump's proposed border wall took shape at a construction site in San Diego. Now, those are the top stories in the news. But the Bible has some things to say about the whole area of immigration and welcoming the stranger. So that's what we want to jump in with today. But Daniel, maybe we can start out with just let's take DACA just as a way to kind of jump in and maybe help us understand the program, the arguments for and against it, and maybe more importantly, then we'll get into, you know, what does the Bible really say about our care for those that are immigrating?
Yes, I mean, DACA is basically designed for the children of people who came undocumented. In fact, I have a family that are friends of mine. I'm here in the Chicago area now, but I was in Denver for many years. And his court date actually is today. And he's been in this country for about 15 years or more. And their older son came when he was one. And so he's basically, this is the only thing he knows. And two other children were born here later. But this would be the kind of situation you're looking at, where these kids were brought with their parents. They were small. and they've been raised here. So the idea is to give an opportunity for these children to become part in some way of the country they've grown up in and allow them to contribute to the national good, basically. And so this personal family that I know, it strikes close to home. In fact, I emailed the wife this morning and said I was praying for them and to please let me know what happened as soon as the court time was over. So you've got these families that have been here for years. The mean stay now is over a decade with these families. I know there's students here in the Chicago area. I've talked to a number of them. They've been here since they were little, and this is all they know. Some of them don't even speak Spanish. This is all they know. So that's what DACA is trying to do. It's trying to help these young people become part of the community.
You know, Nanny, one of the issues is that, and you address it in the book, is that somehow we think immigration is that it's only sort of current, ongoing, people crossing borders today. And obviously there's some of that. But what most, I guess, those that have immigrated have been here for many years, like you said. Even this situation has been, 15, 20 years for these families.
Yes, and you can actually see this in the Bible from chapter 1 when, God creates humanity. He gives them the mandate to subdue the earth, but also to fill it. So how do we do that? Well, we do it by migrating. And the history of the world is really the history of migration. Even in this country, people migrate. They're not migrating across national borders, but they're migrating across state lines and things like that, looking for new work, new starts. And this is the history of the world, actually. What's made it more acute in these days are the natural disasters, the wars, especially in Africa and in the Middle East. All kinds of things are creating this push factor that we're seeing globally. So what we're having globally, it's a global issue. We estimate that over 230 million people are migrating as we speak. It's just the sheer numbers that we've never seen in history before. But the phenomenon is just a human phenomenon since day one, basically.
And I was interested, too, just in looking at your book again, Christians at the Border, that, we've had biases against ethnic groups for many times, thinking, the Chinese during Gold Rush days, but, the Irish, the Italian, and just any number of those. This is not just a Hispanic or a Latino issue, is it?
No, in fact, I lived in Guatemala. I worked in Guatemala as a professor for 13 years, and this was the time of the civil wars. This would have been the 80s and early 90s. And so in Guatemala, there was an influx of people coming up from Nicaragua because of the whole cultural issue, people coming in from El Salvador. And there was biases against those newcomers. We lived in Costa Rica for a year during the Sandinista time, and there was tens of thousands of people from Nicaragua going south to the next door neighbor, which was Costa Rica. And again, what you were seeing were biases against the newcomers. So, this is just a very human reaction, again, which is global. You're seeing it in Europe. You're seeing it within Latin America. And, of course, you see it in the Bible, too, where foreigners, whether you're talking about the Egyptians and the Israelites in Exodus 1, or look at what happens to Daniel. They want to eliminate him. This is just a very human reaction that we witness worldwide.
So when we look at the Bible, knowing that at the human level, we have biases against the newcomer, how did the Old Testament, I guess particularly, you're a professor of Old Testament, how did that set up a different way to view and to care for and to understand those that are migrating?
Well, what's interesting is that you can look at the Bible and its, let's say its laws in the Old Testament law, which reflects, I think, the heart of God, because in Deuteronomy 10, verses 17 to 19, which I think is a very key passage, God commands his people to love the foreigner because he does. and not to forget that they were once foreigners in a foreign land too. So what you see is this command in the Old Testament to take care of those who are vulnerable, who are migrating, whether it's because of hunger or warfare in the Old Testament. But the other part that's interesting for me, as I know immigrants and talk to immigrants, is that what they find in the scriptures are stories of migration that in many ways parallel theirs. And so what I find sometimes for the majority culture, you're trying to use the Bible to show in the Bible that God loves vulnerable people, and this would include immigrants. But on the other hand, if you are an immigrant, what you begin to see is that in the Bible that God actually cares about you and that he is concerned about you. And so it's kind of it's a double conversation that I have, depending on who I'm speaking with. And that's been fascinating for me to watch, because the Old Testament in particular is full of stories of migration, lots of them in Genesis and the Exodus and the move across Sinai over into the Promised Land, and then the exiles, all these things. This is the story of the people of God in the Old Testament.
We'll talk more about the migration of people around the globe, and the particulars it relates to our policy in America. And as believers, how do we look at immigration and respond to it? Talking about the book Christians at the Border, Immigration, the Church, and the Bible, written by Daniel Carroll. Danny is a professor of the Blanchard Chair of Old Testament at Wheaton Grad School. And he's also an adjunct professor in Guatemala City there. He's an author, editor of several books, and he's with us today here on Connecting Faith as we're talking immigration. And we'll get to questions like, what does it mean to be an American? And how do we let the Bible inform, as believers, do we let the Bible inform our positions and decisions on immigration? We'll get Danny's perspective on that coming up in a moment. We do have some copies, I think three copies of the book to give away. It's a wonderful resource, really help you understand this issue better and to get a great biblical framework for it as well. Christians at the Border is the book. You can sign up for a copy today with a phone call. The number is 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. And if you have a question, like to join the conversation, we'd welcome that as well. And we'll talk more in just a moment. Today with Danny Carroll. Daniel Carroll is a Blanchard Chair of Old Testament, is a professor, a distinguished professor there at Wheaton Graduate School in the Chicago area, and he's worked in the area of caring for immigrants and how the Bible relates to that. He also actually spent part of his growing up years in Guatemala. And so has taught as an adjunct professor there at the seminary in Guatemala City, and has authored several books. The one we're referencing today is called Christians at the Border, Immigration, the Church, and the Bible. I know, Danny, the title itself sort of has, I guess, a double meaning. Maybe just say a bit more about just the title of the book and your decision to write in this area.
Right. It's an interesting story, and I'll just kind of make it brief because I could go on a little bit. But my mother was Guatemalan, so I was born and raised bilingual, bicultural, and spent most of my summers growing up in Guatemala. And then later on, I went down and I taught for all those years in Guatemala. And when I came back is when I to the U.S. with my family is when I began to see the need to speak to this biblically. And so that's how it all began for me, actually, was just asking myself, because I didn't have any idea what the Bible might have to say. And since I'm an Old Testament prof, I focus on the Old Testament, and I was just surprised just how much was there about immigration and migration. So that's how it started for me, and kind of a surprising journey when I wrote the book. It's now in its second edition, and I guess that's the one that you're speaking mm-hmm. about. I think it's important for Christians to ground their idea about immigration in the scriptures. There's a Lifeway poll that was taken about a year or so ago. And it was actually kind of shocking, but not surprising in a sense, because it said the results of the poll were that about 12% of evangelical Christians base their view on immigration on the Bible. And that's really not how it should be, but that's the reality. So what happens is we're shaped by our news, we're shaped by our political party, and then we might go to the Bible for a verse or two to kind of buttress a point of view that we built on other grounds, actually, instead of doing it the other way around. And so that's what the book's all about. That's what spurred it, and that's what I've been involved with now for a little over a decade, and because I am half Guatemalan, it makes it a little more personal for me.
Do we look at, you know, what the Bible says, at least maybe the Old Testament, say, well, that's Old Testament, that was just sort of a rules and regs for the children of Israel as they moved into Canaan, so, you know, it doesn't really have full relevance for us?
Well, that's a fair question, and actually the response is to just look at it a very different kind of way. What we see is that the Old Testament laws are reflecting certain basic foundational principles in the heart of God himself. So, no, we're not supposed to imitate how Israel did it over 2,000 years ago, but the underlying principle to love the vulnerable, and in the Old Testament law and in the accounts, there's actually four groups that are supposed to be cared for: the poor, the widows, and the orphans. And the fourth group that the Old Testament will put in to that list are the foreigners, what we would call the immigrants, because they were vulnerable just as they are today. It doesn't make them all good people. If you believe in the Bible, then you know that we're all sinners. And so in any group of people, whether they're native-born here or foreigners, there will be a certain element that will be bad. That's just the reality of a fallen humanity. But that shouldn't negate the need to care for those who are in need.
So when we get into areas like safe cities or cities of refuge, I mean, that was an Old Testament concept as well. And you know, today, or this week, this trial beginning about undocumented in San Francisco, how do you kind of work through some of those issues maybe in your coffee conversations with friends and neighbors?
Yeah, that's a complicated one. And actually, there's a legal issue on the table because in terms of U.S. immigration law, it's federal jurisdiction. It's been that way since about 1875. So part of the reason that local law enforcement, whether they're so-called sanctuary cities or not, don't want to get involved, one is the financial resources that would need to be put into place to even get involved in immigration issues when it's not their jurisdiction. And secondly, what happens is once local law enforcement gets involved in things like that, then in those communities that have tens of thousands of immigrants are fearful that if they do report a crime that they will get picked up themselves, even if they're in no way breaking the law. It shuts down local law enforcement. And the help that local communities need to give so that local law enforcement actually can work. So it's also a legal national debate. So that needs to be understood as well. I think what ends up happening is it gets simplified, as the media tends to do, and they kind of make it cities versus government, cities, somehow standing up to try to thwart the government. And actually, it's much more complex than that. But that's one of the motivations, let alone the moral motivation to even talk about, quote-unquote, sanctuary cities.
Yeah. Well, even, I guess, the wall, we talk about law enforcement. I mean, there, it seems like there's some reasonableness to having border security, but this has become quite the hot potato in terms of debates, about just having a wall. That obviously isn't going to solve all of what has happened so far in where we are in immigration policy today.
Yeah, and the sad thing is that, again, because we always try to make it very simplistic, those of us who are involved in immigration reform are not against border security. What ends up happening in terms of the labeling is if you're in favor of immigration reform, which is another discussion, you know, that gets classified as amnesty and open borders, which is not the case at all, but that's the caricature. And what we need to do is separate the debate about national security, which is about entry, which I totally understand, from the idea of helping those who have been here now for many years, we think maybe around 11 million. It's no longer about border security. It's about how do we engage these people to somehow incorporate them into national life. That's a separate discussion. And what ends up happening is those get conflated, those get mixed up together, and then get tossed around and confused. And for me, they're very separate kind of discussions. I mean, ultimately, they are related, but they are actually distinct conversations that need to be had.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking, we were touched on DACA at the beginning, that you know, probably most of us don't even know what the 14th Amendment says. And we have had policy in the past that has tried to build in some protections and some wise understanding. I mean, obviously, we got a lady in New York Harbor welcoming the least and the lost. So this country has had some history in being a welcoming nation.
Well, it's always been a checkered story because the Statue of Liberty gets put up in New York Harbor and. The 1880s. It's also the decade where we pass our first piece of major national immigration legislation, which was the Chinese Exclusion Act, which would not allow any Chinese, with very, very few exceptions, even into this country. And there was history behind that, as you mentioned, the Gold Rush a little while ago. And that law was in place until 1943. So even as we were saying, on the one hand, welcome. On the other hand, I have an article written by Benjamin Franklin, and it's fascinating to read because he's worried about the Germans because there were some German colony, groups in the larger colonies, and he was worried that they would never assimilate, that they would keep speaking German and keep their churches and keep their schools and keep their stores and. So this issue about the newcomer is historic in this country, but it's been kind of a checkered story. We tend to idealize it. You mentioned Irish immigrants. Well, we have St. Patrick's Day, which is a memory of that, but we really did not treat the Irish very well. We tend to forget some of the darker stories.
Mm-hmm. When we come back, we'll talk more with Daniel Carroll, who's a Blanchard Chair of Old Testament at Wheaton Graduate School. Joining us today is author of a great book called Christians at the Border. We've got some copies to give away. 877-93-FAITH is the phone number. 877-933-2484. We'll do a drawing here for those three copies here at the top of the hour. And if you have a question or a comment and want to join us in our immigration discussion, give us a call and we'll be back in a moment.
This is church when we gather around.
Talking about immigration, the church, and the Bible. That's the subtitle of a book called Christians at the Border, written by Daniel Carroll. Danny is a distinguished professor of the Blanchard Chair of Old Testament at Wheaton Graduate School. He was distinguished professor of Old Testament at Denver Seminary, Colorado, for a number of years. Also helped found a Spanish language training program and is an adjunct professor at the seminary in Guatemala City, Guatemala. He spent a lot of his summers in Guatemala, has written on and speaking on the issue of immigration for a number of years, and we're honored to have him back with us on Connecting Faith. And we have been talking a little bit about some biblical principles, looking at your specialty, kind of the Old Testament, Daniel. So does the New Testament change any of the Old Testament principles or expand on them? Give us a sense of how we welcome the stranger from a New Testament perspective.
Yes. No, it doesn't really contradict or head in a different direction in many ways. It deepens it. And the way you can see this very easily, I just mentioned three real quickly. You know, one is Jesus actually begins his life as a refugee. I mean, when Herod is trying to kill the baby boys, he and his family flee to Egypt. We think they probably went to Alexandria. There was a large Jewish community there. They were there for a time and then eventually came back after Herod's death. So even Jesus begins his life as a refugee. But then you can also see it from the very beginning of the church in Jerusalem. They have problems between the Jewish believers and the Greek believers. And so it's an ethnic problem even from the very opening days of the church. And if you move then into the book of Acts, Paul is putting together a multiracial, multi-ethnic team that goes all around the Mediterranean and going to Jewish synagogues of the diaspora. And then you get into the letters, the epistles, of course, and we're told that those kind of divisive lines that humans tend to make between different cultures and ethnicities have to come down in the body of Christ. So that concern to transcend our natural ethnic national identities, not to eliminate them because we are who we are, but now in Christ something more significant has happened. So you're not seeing doing away with the Old Testament. In some ways, you may be seeing a deepening of God's concern and now calling his people to be a different body.
Well, as we were chatting a little bit during the break, the reality is that many coming to this country, at least from a place in Latin America, have a faith already or certainly very interested in a Christian faith. So talk a little bit about how you see the church growing, Hispanic church growing particularly.
Well, what we know from statistics is that every major denomination in this country is either holding steady in its numbers, or if there's any growth in the numbers, it's based on immigrant churches, not just Hispanic, whether it's African or whatever. So what you're seeing is, in many ways, in his grace, God is revitalizing the church in this country through immigrants. So when I was in Denver, for instance, we had an idea, it's hard to count, that there were 200 or more immigrant Hispanic churches, and that doesn't even take into account the Russian churches, the Ethiopian churches, the Brazilian, which is a bit different than the Spanish-speaking, of course, and all these other kinds of churches that are springing up all over the country. And I've talked to Hispanic pastors, and they believe, some of them, that they've been called here to re-evangelize the U.S. as the Anglo population is becoming more and more secularized. Maybe in God's grace, he's brought foreign believers to revitalize us. But every major denomination is seeing the growth in their numbers, and every major denomination has actually signed on to immigration reform, and every major denomination is now starting educational programs to train pastors for those immigrant churches.
Are those within the immigrant church facing unique challenges? I mean, considering our political views and attitudes, at least in this maybe current administration?
I was just in Denver over the weekend, Friday and Saturday. I went down there to teach in the Spanish-speaking program that I helped start a number of years ago. And I was talking to the director, who's from Honduras. His wife is Guatemalan. And they were telling me that the numbers were down and that this was also happening in local churches because he was saying that now people are afraid to travel. They're afraid that they might be stopped by a policeman. And so we have these fellow believers who have been studying the Bible and theology at the seminary, usually in the evenings or Saturdays now, or some of them are too scared to travel. Even church attendance on Sundays, there's been cases now in this country in the last few months where immigration officials are waiting outside church buildings. And so they're afraid to even go to church because maybe when you walk out, there will be immigration people to pick you up. So that's the kind of climate in some parts of the country that we're seeing. I can't make a blanket statement, but that's some of what we're seeing.
Is there a path for, you know, clearing, you know, this up and eliminating this fear? It seems like, you know, this has been with us for some time, but not like it's getting any better.
Yeah, I think probably the most important thing is just to have a civil conversation without the rhetoric. I gave you the example of how border security gets mixed up with what to do with the 11 million people who are already inside. But that conversation doesn't seem to happen. Another thing is just to educate people about immigration law. It's very outdated. It doesn't work. I'll give you an example. The U.S. immigration system works on quotas, well, by category. And so, for instance, the national annual quota for unskilled labor. Now, this would be construction, landscaping, things like this. The national quota, if you want to come in with a visa for that kind of job, is 5,000. That's just insanely ridiculous. So even if we would just revisit the quotas to adjust them to our economic need, would make common sense. But those kind of commonsensical discussions don't seem to happen in this political climate. So when people say, why don't they get in line and get a visa? Well, there's no line to get into. And if you're in this country, there's another problem with current law. Current law does not have any provision for you once you're inside without papers. So there is no line to go to, no fine to pay, no way of making it right, even if you wanted to, and they do. The only thing that current legislation contemplates is deportation. So if we could have a conversation about border security, working with these people who have been here for this 11 million people who have been here for many years, whether if they have any back taxes to pay, background checks, all of that's been part of the immigration reform discussion. But the national climate won't let it happen, and that's the sad part. So the pawns that get played are the immigrants who are just trying to work and feed their kids and work for a new future.
You know, you talk about just having a civil conversation. Perhaps some hospitality would go a long way in terms of welcoming the stranger, that if we actually did that, we would get to hear people's stories a bit more.
And I think what you just said is key. It's just hear people's stories. My experience is that oftentimes people who are anti-immigrant oftentimes don't know any. It's just kind of a faceless mass that they hear about in the media. But once they see and get to know some of these moms and dads and the kids, you know, my experience has been it changes because now they're just like you and me. Now, it doesn't mean that the system should be avoided or anything like that, but what it does mean is it puts a human face to it so that we can have a civil conversation that's actually constructive. And I think that's what we would love to be able to do for the sake of these people and for the sake of the country, because if we can facilitate their integration, what it could do for the country economically, brain power, all kinds of things is amazing. And that's the kind of conversation we need.
So have you thought about maybe what it means to be American? And has that changed over the years, maybe for you, as you've seen this conversation go on and on for decades now?
Yeah. I think what people need to realize is that what it means to be American is changed ever since the founding of the Republic. Every new wave of immigration, and there's been different waves, the largest immigration into this country in the middle of the 19th century were the Germans, and then at the end of the 19th century it was the Italians and the Irish. As we've absorbed, the national profile has changed. One of the reasons that, 100 and some odd years ago, that there was an anti-Irish and an anti-Italian immigration set of laws, they were strict quotas put on them as nations of origin, was that they were Catholic versus Protestant. And we were a Protestant country, so we didn't want the Catholics. So all this has been very common. But what the U.S. has is wonderfully absorbent. And so now, you know, even you're watching, even as people sometimes are anti-Hispanic, we're absorbing their food, you know, the Vive Mas from Taco Bell, the music. If you're going to watch the World Series, just watch how many Latins and that are playing on both teams. And the MVP of the American League, Altuve, tells you that's an Hispanic, right? I mean, so you're seeing it in our sports, you're seeing it in our music, you're seeing it in our food. Their kids are populating. In fact, the fastest growing population of K-12 and university students in the country, the fastest growing group, are Hispanics. So it's going to happen. If we, you know, if we want to do it well and in a constructive way, that'd probably be the best way to do it.
Well, Danny, our time is gone. We've just got a minute or so left. The book is an important summary of not only what the Old Testament has to say, but what the New Testament has to say as we look at immigration, the church, and the Bible. But, you know, if the book is called Christians at the Border. If you could maybe sum up, you know, in a sentence or two what, you know, what you would love to have people take away from the conversation and to carry into any discussions about immigration, what would that be?
Well, I think just in a nutshell, it would just be let the Word of God speak to us, and let that be the basis of what we hold. And I think if I can just encourage people to read the book or other books that would begin with the Scriptures, that would be the place to begin to change our tone and maybe the direction of the national debate, at least from the Christian side.
Yeah, if we, as you said, that Lifeway polls suggesting only 12% for a look at the Bible for their information on this. So let's, you know, increase that percentage and see how that could help us influence those that are making these important decisions. Danny, great to have you on again today. I always appreciate the conversation. Daniel Carroll is the Blanchard Chair of Old Testament at the Graduate School, Wheaton College, joining us today. And he's written a book called Christians at the Border: Immigration, the Church, and the Bible, the second edition we're referencing today. We do have some copies of it to give away, and you can sign up for it with a phone call at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. Past the hour, and on this Monday, we make a point to check in with Lisa Marone, who provides a Monday morning health tip every Monday, and we have Lisa on every other Monday just to review some of those important tips. Lisa is a physical therapist, a professor, an author, and a speaker, and some 20-plus years in the healthcare field, encouraging us to get healthy for heaven's sake, and she's authored a number of books relating to sleeping and back pain, diabetes, and headaches, all those kinds of things. Today, we're going to talk about something that all of us do probably not well. At least I'm going to admit to that. Well, Lisa, welcome first. Let's get that in here before you can start telling me how I should work on my posture a little bit.
Neil, it is always great to be with you. Thank you for the opportunity to help people be well, for God's sake.
All right. So we're going to talk today 5 L's and 1 B. What we're talking about is lifting. And I'm sure, you know, as a physical therapist, you have seen one or two patients that have tweaked their back just because they were out of position and doing some lifting.
Yeah, Neil, I've been treating patients for nearly 30 years now. And so, yes, I have seen my fair share of patients who have come in and, you know, they didn't mean to hurt themselves lifting, but they've either done it too quickly, they've done it without thinking, or, you know, they thought they had it under control, but they really didn't.
And I guess, you know, before we maybe dive into some of those things, that the fact is that it may not necessarily be heavy, right? It doesn't have to be that we're, you know, trying to lift a, you know, spare tire or something. It could just be something small that we pick up from maybe the wrong angle.
Yeah, you know, sometimes lifting, if we reach over the couch to grab something or out of our reach, we sometimes put ourselves in jeopardy, our spine's in jeopardy by doing that. So there are these five L's that are just a really great thing to kind of run through a mental checklist before you go lifting, but especially, Neil, something that we think is going to be taxing on us.
All right, so let's start. The five L's. Number one.
Yeah, the first L stands for load, and it means check the load before you go lift it off the floor. And what I mean by that is don't just assume the weight of something. We should grab hold of it and maybe rock it a little bit, do a kind of tentative lift of it, get an idea of how heavy it is, because your body is going to set itself based upon that. And so it's really important that we have that in check to begin with.
That's the first L. The second is lever. What do we mean by that?
Yeah, lever doesn't mean we use a lever to pick it up. It just means the concept of a lever would mean that the closer something is to your center of gravity, the lighter it will be. That's why we don't carry our groceries in from the car with our arms extended away from our bodies. That would make that load too heavy. And, you know, we always say that the Lord has the whole world in his hands, but I'm sure he does, and he's holding it close to his center of gravity because he's pretty wise, and he created those rules of physics. So for lever, we want that lever, the load that we're going to lift, we want it as close to our pelvic area, as close to the center of our gravity as possible.
And because does that just, well, I guess let's go on, we'll come back. So the third one, that's a fancy medical word that I can't even pronounce, I don't think.
It's called lordosis, L, lordosis. And what that is that backwards C curve in your low back. Now, in healthy posture, the way that God created our spine, our low back should naturally be in a C curve, a backward-facing C. And that is there to protect our discs. When we have a flat back or we have a rounded forward back, it's almost like we've opened the door for our discs to bulge or to possibly herniate. And so it's really important when we're going to lift a large load that we've checked it out first. That's the load. The second is the lever. We've gotten ourselves real close to it. We've even kind of straddled it on the catty corner if you need to. And then we've put this lordosis or this arch in our back. And when my patients don't understand how to create that, I tell them that their pelvis is like a bowl of water. And if they were going to tip some water out the front of that bowl, and their belly button would have to drop towards the floor to do that, and their rear end would have to raise towards the ceiling. So it's that forward tipping of the pelvis that's going to create that lordosis, that backward C curve that protects our low back.
Now, that seems a little counterintuitive, isn't it, that we'd think that we'd want to be as straight as possible, wouldn't we, when we're lifting?
And most people will bend forward because the object is in front of them. But if you have an object that's heavy, that say it's over, for me, for my size and weight, 20 pounds, for you maybe 30, something that's going to be heavy, we do want to cock our butt up in the air so we have that arch, because that's where our muscles are going to be strong, that's where our discs are going to be protected. So it's actually, you know, Neil, a long time ago when you and I were working out in the gym, everybody told us to keep our backs flat. You know, if you did stomach exercises or things on the floor, they'd say, you know, push your back into the floor. That's completely incorrect. They've found that is not where our strong suit is. So we need to have that arch in our low back. And, of course, that's the way God created it. So I don't know why we went against that.
Yeah, well, there is that. All right. So that's the third one. The fourth one, of course, is where we're going to do the key to the lift, right? That's with our legs.
Yeah. You know, and what I love to introduce, you had said there's five L's and one B. This is where I throw my little B in between this lordosis and the L, the fourth L, which is legs. Is a brace. Before we go and perform this lift, I don't tell people to go put a brace on their back, like one of those elastic things that people Velcro to themselves. Those are next to useless. What I ask them to do is create a brace with their deepest abdominal muscles. It's called your transverse abdominis muscle. And it's a muscle that creates, when it turns on the muscles of your pelvic floor, and it turns on the deep core muscles of your spine. And the way that someone would turn on that abdominal brace would be just to gently draw their belly button in toward their spine. It's not a huge effort. It's not a bearing down like you're pushing or you're getting ready for someone to punch you in the stomach. It's just as if you had a stomach ache and your pants were a little too tight and you just had to draw your belly button away from your waistband. So I insert a little B here in between all these L's that after you get yourself in that arched position, you put on your abdominal brace and then kneel. The fourth L is legs. God created us with large thigh muscles and buttock muscles, and those are so much stronger than our muscles of our spine. And so when we go to lift an object off the floor, we need to bend our knees and then not lift it up with our back, but we need to intentionally push our feet through the floor so that we're using the strongest muscles in our body to lift not only our body weight, but that the other thing that we're carrying as well.
That one we've heard since we're little, right? To lift with your legs, not with your back,
lift
right?
Lift with your legs. Lift with your legs, yes.
All right. So the fifth L is one that we maybe wouldn't have thought of.
The fifth L is for lungs. And what this actually protects is not necessarily your back, but it protects your heart. If you were to hold your breath and then create a big forceful motion like a lift, what you do is you squeeze close your main blood vessel that's leading towards your heart. And then as soon as you were to exhale, you would get a huge load of blood up to the heart. And some people will even give themselves a small heart attack by doing something like that. And so that's why if you ever worked out with a trainer or in your physical therapist's office, they're going to tell you while you're exercising, they always say, keep breathing, don't hold your breath, keep breathing, don't hold your breath. And it has to do with protecting your heart. So while you're performing a large lift, you're going to inhale as you kneel, as you bend your knees and get close to that load, and then you're going to exhale through the lift. That burst of exhalation will actually help you lift that object up, and it'll protect your heart.
Yeah, those are some great tips, and I think if we can just let's review them kind of quickly again, because this is maybe one of the number one reasons why people get some back pain, right?
Yeah, people get injured. So we're going to take a look at the load that we have in front of us, and we're going to check that load. We're going to just sample its weight so we're not surprised by how heavy it is. And then the second, we're going to get ourselves really close to it. We're going to make that lever, that second L, short, and we want to pull that ourselves closer to that object. We're going to lift with an arch, a lordosis in our back. We're going to put that abdominal brace on so that our whole core is strong. And then we're going to lift with our legs, pushing through the floor while we are fifth L, exhaling through our with our lungs, just exhaling that air out and protecting our heart as well.
If by chance, we lifted something this morning before you came on, what's your recommendation if we tweaked our back or hurt ourselves from a lift?
Oftentimes, someone will tweak their back, and it's either a little bulge in their disc or they have pinched a little capsule in one of the joints in their back. I always tell people if your pain is higher than a 5 on a scale of 1 to 10, you should put some ice on it. Ice is an antispasmodic, which means it breaks up spasm. It's an anti-inflammatory, and it's a painkiller. So it's a 3-in-1 package deal. So wet paper towel and the ice pack on for about 10 minutes or so. And then the other thing is we always want to reverse the injury mode. So if you injured yourself bending forward, we do want to restore extension or backward bending. So laying on your belly, putting your chin on your hands like you're a kid watching television, starting to get some extension back is going to help to restore the mobility in your spine.
And find out more, sign up for Lisa Marone's Monday Morning Health Tip, where she talks about this and many other great subjects. Go to lisamarone.com, lisamarone.com. Lisa's our every other Monday guest with her Monday Morning Health Tip, physical therapist, professor, encouraging us to get healthy, for heaven's sakes. Lisa, I always love talking with you. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thanks, Neil.
You're listening to Connecting Faith. Find out more about the ministry online, myfaithradio.com. Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support, and you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.